just a few more lines from The Wasteland, and then I'll go to Basho, and then I'll go to Kandinsky. What we're doing here is we're tasting styles of conscious expression. Here's T.S. Eliot. This is the Burial of the Dead section from The Wasteland. Madame Sosostris, famous clairvoyant, had a bad cold, nevertheless, is known to be the wisest woman in Europe, with a wicked pack of cards. Here, said she, is your card, the drowned Phoenician sailor. Those are the pearls that were his eyes. Look, here is Belladonna, the lady of the rocks, the lady of situations. Here is the man with three staves, and here the wheel. And here is the one-eyed merchant. And this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I am forbidden to see. I do not find the hanged man. Fear death by water. I see crowds of people walking round in a ring. Thank you. If you see dear Mrs. Equitone, tell her I bring the horoscope myself. One must be so careful these days. So a little bit of T.S. Eliot symbolism. Now notice the difference in expressive consciousness when we come to Basho. We've had Mallarmé, we've had Yeats, we've had Eliot, and in that sequence there's a rising consciousness, self-consciousness of form and technique. This is from a little travel log of Basho, the records of a travel-worn satchel. And just this little section here. The day for the spring change of clothing came, and then the haiku. I took a kimono off to feel lighter, only putting it in the load on my back. I was in Nara on the Buddha's birthday and saw the birth of a fawn. I was so struck by the coincidence that I wrote, by what divine consideration is it, I wonder, that this fawn is born on Buddha's birthday? Ganjin, the founder of the Shodaiji temple, is said to have lost his sight on his way to Japan on account of the salt that jumped into his eyes while he endured 70 different trials on the sea. After bowing devoutly before his statue, I wrote, and here's the haiku, if only you allow me, I will willingly wipe salt tears from your eyes with these fresh leaves. So you can see Basho's style of expression. Now we turn to Kandinsky. We've had Mallarmé, Yeats, Eliot, and Basho. Now Kandinsky. This is from Concerning the Spiritual and Art, and at the end of it there's a sequence of poems of Kandinsky's. This poem was first published in the Dada Review, Cabaret Voltaire, 1916. The title of it is Seeing. Blue. Blue arose and fell. Sharp, thin, whistled and penetrated, but did not pierce through. Everywhere a rumbling. Thick brown, hovered seemingly for all eternity. Seemingly, seemingly, spread your arms wider, 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 and cover your face with a red cloth. And perhaps it is not yet displaced at all. Only you have displaced yourself. White chink after white chink. And in this white chink, a white chink. In every white chink, a white chink. It is not good that you fail to see the turbid. It is precisely in the turbid that it dwells. And that is where everything begins. Then there was a crash. Kandinsky is very close to Basho, but Kandinsky is using a thought structure to try and power what Basho does with consummate art. Basho just does it. His language is like a samurai's sword. It flashes once and has already cut, and you haven't seen any movement. Whereas with Kandinsky, you have all the flourishes of the mind muscling itself up for this elusive activity, and you don't see it, but you get the sense that all the muscling up has relaxed. Something has happened. And then there was a crash. Now Kandinsky, in Concerning the Spiritual and Art, which was written down, he said, during 1910 and towards the end of 1911, December of 1911, the first edition was printed up, and it sold out right away, and there was another printing in 1912 in December, in January, and then later on in the autumn there was yet another printing, and then there was a second edition in 1914. It was a clarion call in the art world. It was a call that the movement from symbolism, the movement from impressionism, the movements in modern art had somehow mysteriously poked through a center of integration that they had been aiming at all the while, but having arrived there did not arrive anywhere but penetrated through to a new realm. Kandinsky said of this new realm that this was abstract, in the sense that nature is no longer the harbinger of the criteria by which art proceeds. The harbinger of the criteria by which art proceeds now is the mysterious self. And if you have to think of it in a colloquial sense, the self has displaced nature as the foundation for art. And Kandinsky says that this is, in comparison to art before, this art is abstract. Now, even though he was Russian, he wrote this originally in German, in Munich, where he had been for, well, since 1896, about 16 years. Munich was always considered by the Russians of that time as being the gateway to the culture of the West. Not Paris, but Munich. There was in the 19th century, there was a taste in the aristocratic Russians for French culture and the effect of the French language. And towards the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, Russians who were affine to folk traditions rejected the aristocratic taste for French culture and chose the Bavarian German culture instead as a conscious choice, not to do what the old aristocrats had done, to do something new. So the you can close that if you want. It'll latch. Go ahead. So he was in Munich, and when he wrote this, he used the term in here, Gegenstandslot, which means, in usual translation, non-objective. But Kandinsky was very careful, many times, to oppose the use of the term non-objective. It was not that what he was dealing with was non-objective. His whole purpose was to go to an inner light which rises and glows as the dematerialization of the material world proceeds. So it isn't non-objective, but it is abstract. One is taking the energy from the dissolving forms of the material world and reusing it from within to express an abstract sense of composition, an abstract sense of color, not at all non-objective, but truly abstract. He objected to the negative in non-objective, and also the linking of the negative with the material world, as if somehow this was still this was an anti-materialism. Kandinsky was sophisticated enough to know that you're still caught up in something, even if you're protesting against it, you're still caught up into it in the negative sense. He meant that this was completely new. This was completely different. That what had been the material basis had been dissolved. And that out of that transformation, of its dissolution, a new center came into being that radiated an inner light. And that this inner light was able to compose abstractly. So there's a very different thing. Here's the beginning of Kandinsky concerning the spiritual and art. Every work of art is a child of its time. Often it is the mother of our emotions. It follows that each period of culture produces an art of its own, which cannot be repeated. Efforts to revive the art principles of the past at best produce works of art that resemble a stillborn child. For example, it is impossible for us to live and feel as did the ancient Greeks. For this reason, those who follow Greek principles in sculpture reach only a similarity of form, while their work remains for all time without a soul. Such imitation resembles the antics of apes. Externally, a monkey resembles a human being. He will sit holding a book in front of his nose, turning over the pages with a thoughtful air, but his actions have no real significance. So you can see how Kandinsky begins. He means, though, in a radical sense, that one can never imitate anything that is past. Whatever forms were expressively viable in the past, those must be dissolved. And out of their dissolution, that energy collected in you is the nourishment by which you then express anew from your energized ability, irregardless of the past forms. and that this new expression, because it is new, because it is from the inside and not parallel to anything anyone has seen before, to others it is abstract. To you, it is a legitimate self-expression. And only by acquaintanceship do others come to become acquainted with what you have done, with your expression and so forth. So that there is a quality that Kandinsky means to say that a true artist at any time is always exploring the unknown, always moving into an abstract area which is just now becoming present and has not been seen before. So there is this kind of a quality in his argument, in his writing. He writes it this way. This great point of inner contact is, in spite of its considerable importance, only one point. Only just now awakening, after years of materialism, our soul is infected with the despair born of unbelief, of lack of purpose and aim. The nightmare of materialism, which turned life into an evil, senseless game, is not yet past. It still darkens the awakening soul. Only a feeble light glimmers, a tiny point in an immense circle of darkness. This light is but a presentiment, and the mind, seeing it, trembles in doubt over whether the light is a dream and the surrounding darkness indeed reality. This doubt and the oppression of materialism separate us sharply from primitives. Our soul rings, cracked when we sound it, like a precious vase dug out of the earth which has a flaw. For this reason, the primitive phase through which we are now passing in its present derivative form must be short-lived. In other words, exactly at this time was a great return to the primitive origins of Picasso's cubism has an awful lot of returning to primitive African art. Kandinsky is saying, with high consciousness, yes, this is happening. Yes, this is interesting. But yes, we have to look at this closely and see that this is not the legitimate development. This is characteristic of a floundering and a searching and a blind seeking, but the true movement, the true penetration through is of a different quality. It involves a consciousness of the unknown, which was not there in someone going back to sources, even going back to primordiality. Because the primordiality they're going back to is not the inner primordiality, but someone else's expression of their primordiality. For them it was legitimate, it was primordial, but for us, we would be caught up in imitation. So we have to involve ourselves with the actual, he didn't use this term, but it's the term that carries the meaning. We have to be existentially involved in our own discovery, in our very immediate penetration through to a new expressiveness of our own. Notice that this is the seed of the person. This point of light is the seed of the person. Now, in all the world's great mystical insights, there is always this sense that the beginning of the person is a golden spark of pure light of God, just to put it in this colloquial term. One can call it the moment of the thought of enlightenment, the bodhicitta. One can call it the divine spark. that must be nourished. One can call it the blessed gift of the insight of gold. Whatever it is, it's this that Kandinsky writes about, that at the time that he's writing, only a feeble light glimmers, a tiny point in an immense circle of darkness. Now, what's interesting here is that when that point of light is developed, there's a counter movement to this. And as the point of light is developed, as it gains its radiant wholeness, a spot of blackness occurs. A spot of darkness occurs. So that when one goes to make a composition, and he will use this in Point, Line, and Plane, another one of his books, which Dover has reprinted, and you could take a look at that too. He says that the beginning of all composition is the point. The point of blackness on the white page, which is a complement to the point of light within. In the blackness, the darkness of unknowing. I like unknowing better than darkness. It's more accurate. The only thing one has to go on is that one has a glimmer, however feeble it is, that glimmer does occur. That insight has occurred. And when one goes to express, notice the conversion. It comes out as a point. It's more esoteric than you're thinking of. Even 2,300 years ago, Euclid in Alexandria said, a point is a location without dimension. First proposition in Euclid's geometry. It's as esoteric as that. The only way the dimension occurs is by movement. And if a point moves, one has a line. The movement of a location without dimension gives one a line. Now notice that the fundamental tool of composition, the fundamental composing element in geometry, is mystical in the extreme. Whatever is parallel to that line is a plane. Whatever is parallel to that movement is a plane of reference. All of that in terms of composition is a complementary, paradoxical though it may seem at first, it's a complementary movement to the inner spark of light, which has occurred in a dimension of unknowing. Now, it wasn't unknowing before the light occurred. It was the comfortable world. It was the imitation of the material world. Your inner image base was a representation of the material world. But as soon as this inner point of light is seen, as soon as it is engendered, two processes begin at once. The dissolution of confidence in the material world and the correlate dissolution and lack of confidence in the image base, which was representational and imitational of that. But as they both dissolve, as the exterior world dissolves and the inner image base dissolves, that matter dissolves into energy. There's a rise in energy capacity. That energy at a certain point of concentration is the nourishment for the growth of that spark of light into radiance. And the expression from that radiance is what Kandinsky will say is abstract art. So he's dealing here with a spiritual, the very title of his monograph here, Concerning the Spiritual in Art. Now, I'm sure that many of you saw that exhibit, what was it, a year or two ago, about the spiritual in art that was at the L.A. County Museum. And the key to all that is the development that happened in the 20th century because of Kandinsky. Mr. Hall donated somewhere around two or three dozen books and drawings and mandalas and so forth to that exhibit. And I think the catalog is still in print from the L.A. County Museum. That whole exhibit was the development of some 75 years of what began with this book, this very book that we're using. This book is the equivalent to Einstein's general theory of relativity. It's the seminal work by the seminal mind that was able to understand that what we have here is not a new movement in an ongoing wave of occurrence, but we have a transformation. And while the transformation is probably characteristic of all the great transformations that have occurred, we have to also see this in terms of its radical transformation and follow it wherever it will go. We don't know where it will go. And there's a sense here in Kandinsky's book of saying, look, I'm as scared as anybody. I don't know what's there. I don't know where this is going to go. And I do know that wherever I go, wherever I have been, is going to be completely changed. I will no longer be able to think of it with any kind of confidence as home. And he uses the metaphor in here of the experience of being on an ocean liner, because this is 1911, 1912. He says, when you get out of sight of land and the night comes and the storm whips up black mountains of water, you realize that you have really left port. He said, that's the feeling that he's carrying around. But the way to work with that, notice the beauty of spiritual integrity, the way to work with that is to recognize that you're on the boat in that condition and not to daydream that you're back in port. Let go. Let go of it. You long since have cast off those mooring ropes. You're not there anymore. You can't transpose the expectations and wishes and desires of the dry dock to this situation. This is not what's occurring. And your fearfulness, your scariness, rises in proportion and asymptotically to the impossible of trying to stuff the old images into the current situation. You know it's a lie. You know it's untrue. The way to go is to go with that. To go with that. To open that up. Does it open up? He says, indeed, it opens up. But that opening up for each individual is the development of this abstract style. Notice now, it isn't just the artist or some artists that make some abstract painting. It's a spiritual transformation which is characteristic of the new condition. He writes in here that there are two great signposts that he sees, Matisse in color and Picasso in form. And then he writes, at different points along the road, this new road, the road of the new. At different points along this road are the different arts, each one saying what is best, what it is able best to say by methods peculiarly its own. despite differences, or perhaps even because of them, the various arts have never been closer to each other than in this recent hour of spiritual crisis. Now look here. As all the different arts integrate, as their image bases implode, as they come closer and closer together, there's a sense, a strategic sense, and great artists had this, that somehow there was a master art. There's a master art where all of the media come together into one art form. Now, one of the greatest artists of the 19th century was Richard Wagner. And he said, I'm not writing operas, I'm writing a new art form. I'm transforming Aeschylus into a new art form. And the ring cycle was to be an example of the new art form. The monumental art, the master art, is person making. It's not some ingenious amalgam of artistic mediums together. The true focus is that this is a new person. Why is it a new person? Because this person has not occurred before. Has not occurred in this way before. Is just now beginning to occur. Is radically different from anything else that has happened and is just now occurring in some new way. The flag word that was waved at that time and now is put on every kind of package that you can commercially bait people with, new. This is new. New fab. New shell oil. New. It's a symbolic word like om, which characterizes the very essence of what has happened and what each individual, each of us, those of you who are still here, have had this. Otherwise, you wouldn't still be here. You would have found some reasons not to be here, not to continue. There are other interesting things to do. But because you're here, you have had this experience that you are different from what you once were. Who you are is different from who you once were. In some way, perhaps not altogether clear, perhaps mysterious, perhaps less mysterious. But the certainty and the courage is that somehow this newness is valuable and viable. But viable in its own right. It shouldn't be clothed with cast-offs and hand-me-downs. It should have its own wardrobe. It should have its own day to be. And that's legitimate. So Kandinsky then writes here, despite differences, or perhaps even because of them, the various arts have never been closer to each other than in this recent hour of spiritual crisis. In each expression is the seed of an effort towards the non-representational, abstract, and internal structure. Consciously or unconsciously, they are obeying Socrates' advice, know thyself. And of course, it isn't Socrates' advice. It was the enigmatic reply of the Delphic Oracle, saying that Socrates was the wisest man alive. Why? Because he cannot let go of the question of searching for himself, knowing himself. In his time, Socrates was the abstract man. The reason why the bigwigs of Athens put Socrates to death was that he was teaching the technique of that time to the young men of Athens. He was teaching them to step outside of the state god composition, outside of the whole, not only the power structure, but the mythological and religious underpinnings of the power structure, and to emerge as themselves. And of course, such a person is very dangerous. Every power group that there is out to get such a person. Because if he succeeds, they're out. Not only out, but out of business. So the pioneer, as Kandinsky says, the artist who steps through is always this kind of a terrific being. So he writes here, consciously or unconsciously, artists are studying and investigating their material, weighing the spiritual value of those elements with which it is their privilege to work. And we talked before about the existentialist ethic as opposed to the Kantian categorical ethic. The Kantian categorical ethic says that before you do something, you have to ask, what if everyone did this? Whereas the existentialist ethic is, you ask yourself, what if no one did this? And very often the answer is, this life, this universe would be minus this value. I would like to put this value into play, so I will do it. Irregardless of the consideration, what if everyone does this? It's a way of turning one's back 180 degrees on the masses, so-called, in a derisive sense, and being your own person. So he writes here, the natural result of this work is a comparison of the elements of one art with those of another. The natural result of this work is a comparison of the art elements of one art with those of another. That's why we're taking so many different art forms together at the same time. Because when we deal with the art of person making, we need to have a number of media, four or five at least, concurrently active in our sensitivity, so that our expressive insight is not limited to a metaphor of procedure based on one media. Why? Because the mind subconsciously looks for some kind of diagrammatic hook upon which to hang the new insights. And it's the hook, no matter what it is, that hangs you up. And so you have to guard against it. And the way to guard against it is to keep it as multidimensional as possible, so that the old habits of making these hooks don't work. I said Thursday night, I'll say again to you, when you find teachers who love to draw the diagrams on the board, it might be time to leave. Because the development of the new is always problematical. It's always new. We don't know what it's going to be. It's unknown. We have to have courage to walk into the unknown. What's Krishnamurti's little book, Freedom from the Known? I think he did a book, Freedom from the Known, which deals incessantly with that issue, the only revolution there is. The existential beginning with the unknown is very, very difficult if you have any kind of convenient hooks that you still have confidence that you can hang things up on, because you're going to use them. Why? Because the uneasiness, the unsettledness is going to rise and become ever more important and insistent to you. This is why, for instance, in the technique of Zen, the use of a koan, the use of a koan to destroy your capacity to make these little crooks. There's no way that you're going to be left with any working tools from the past. You may go back and reappropriate later whatever elements you want to, but in that moment of transformation, in that development of the spark of the light, it's got to be cold turkey, first time out, 100%. To whatever extent you hold back, to that extent you self-deceive. It has always been that way, is still that way. So that's why the spiritual requires courage. Courage. It really does. Whenever you see somebody who is themselves, some person who has come into being themselves, they have gone through it all. Nobody gets there free. So he writes here, Kandinsky writes, about sometimes music is found to be the best teacher, and for some centuries, with few exceptions, music has been the art which has devoted itself not to the reproduction of natural phenomena, but to the expression of the artist's soul, and to the creation of an autonomous life of musical sound. And Kandinsky will use Beethoven and Mozart as examples, and some of you may know that Arnold Schoenberg was one of Kandinsky's closest friends, and a great correspondence was passed between them. And I have a volume of the translated correspondence between Kandinsky and Schoenberg. If I can find it, I'll play Transfigured Night by Arnold Schoenberg for you. And you can see an early composition written about the same time as Kandinsky doing concerning the spiritual and art. He writes here, in the application of form, music can achieve results which are beyond the reach of painting, but painting is ahead of music in several particulars. And this is where painting is extremely important. Music, for example, has at its disposal duration of time, while painting can present to the spectator the whole content of its message at one moment. He's using the term present very specifically, not represent, but present. The usual way that painting appreciation is taught almost forbids one to do this. The usual art appreciation courses in American universities destroys the aesthetic moment. In fact, the way Monet first really understood the aesthetic moment, confirmed it to himself, was seeing an exhibition of ukiyo-e prints in Paris, which set him off to collecting, in particular, about 5,000 prints, most of them by Hiroshige. How is this so? If one, I'll make it melodramatic so that you can get the point here. If one stares at Hiroshige's long enough, just stares at them, when you look away, whatever you look at with Hiroshige eyes. And you can walk out of the museum or the gallery, and whatever you look at with Hiroshige eyes. And you realize that there's an indelible knack of compositional focus which this artist has been able to use in his self-expression. We'll wait for the machines. Are you getting tired?